Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue open a, well, let's do a work session on 3488 Center George.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3488.
Senator George has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill, or House Bill 3488. All those in favor say any objections to that motion? So ordered. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3488 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved that we reconsider the vote by which HBR 3488 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I better add, as amended.
As amended, with the due pass discussion. Objections to that motion? So ordered. Okay, so the B-11s.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, move the dash 11 amendments.
3488. Senator Monroe has moved the dash 11 B-11 amendments. Does anyone care need to discuss this issue? Do you want to have someone up and talk about them?
If we need to, but my understanding that this correction really needs to be in the bill.
Yes, and some of the affected parties, and they just didn't make it to our committee to explain it to us, and so we're granting them a favor by pulling this bill back in and amending their portions into the bill. And
I think if we're in agreement, and you know, I understood when they came in that, you know, they'd been in other testimony, and it seemed very reasonable for me to do it, so I would support the 11 months.
Great. Further discussion? Any objections to that motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move 3488 back to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved Senate House Bill 3488 as amended back to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion?
Good bill should pass.
So ordered. Who was carrying that bill? We'll have Senator Burdick now that we put in.
Yeah, I was thinking she, I think it was Burdick.
Was it Burdick? Mm-hmm. And these B-11s help out the city of Portland, so it'll give her, she gets her district. Okay. Open a, Chris, I want to have you talk about 2810 and why we're still waiting on that. So I'll open a work session on 2810. And Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you recall yesterday, there was the conceptual amendment to B3 that the committee wanted to adopt. B3's as drafted only extended the refundability of the credit free tax year 2012, and so the conceptual amendment was, which just changed the date from 2013 to 2014, extended it through tax year 2013, which was the committee's preference. Upon editing in Ledge Council, they noted that there was a time discrepancy between that and the repeal of the credit, because the other policy that the committee wanted was to repeal the sunset the entire credit on January 1, 2014. And on line 12, there was a January 2nd date. And so the situation there was that it would be in effect for one day. So they drafted an amendment B6, which incorporated the 2014, but then they modified that line 12 to apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2015, which essentially extended the sentence, the repeal of the credit to January 1, 2015. So then the credit still if the B6s were to be adopted, the credit would exist for tax year 2014 in a non-refundable fashion. And the policy intent was to effectively eliminate the sunset on the refundability, but sunset the whole credit on January 1, 2014. So in tax year, through tax year 2013, it would be a 6% refundable credit, and then for tax year 2014, there would be no credit. And currently, I spoke with council this morning and cleared up the issues, so we're on the same page, and they are currently drafting a different version that would achieve that goal.
Okay, so we'll get B7s, I would guess, but we don't have them right now.
We don't have them right now. They were working on them very quickly this morning.
Do we need to reconsider this to bring it back now and deal with it later? Or we just
Why don't we just do it? We'll get the B7s, take the B6s out and put the B7s, or take our own conceptual B6s out and put the B7s in. Okay, so I'll close the work. Any questions for Chris, just so we're all set to go when we get the B7s on 2810? Pretty simple. Close work session on House Bill 2810, 2171. We're obviously not ready to go on that one. And 2735.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I could explain the amendment that is, it'll be ready any momentarily, and that I've asked for.
Open work session on House Bill 2735, Senator Monroe.
Now, I've been working with all of the folks on this issue, and I've tried to make all of them a little happier, but not totally happy. And so the amendment that I've asked for essentially grandfathers in the four cities that have current ordinances: Eugene, Wilsonville, Bend, and Oregon City, and gives them up to 6 months to adjust their ordinances, and absolutely forbids any other local government from passing any ordinance that exceeds 2735.
And we're, Mayor, we're not going to do 2735, so.
And I have been negotiating with members of the House who are in concurrence with this approach, especially those representatives from Eugene that were very concerned about this measure. And I believe that with this amendment, we'll be able to achieve concurrence in the House.
Oh, good. Okay, that's important. Okay, well, anyone that did not have a chance to speak yesterday, we have about 10 minutes to burn on 2735. Great. I noticed, Rick, you didn't get a chance to speak yesterday. And while we're waiting, Brenneman and Bill Perry have the same shirt on, just about identical as they walked in.
I'd like to be more like my father.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to briefly speak on this issue. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. Our preference when we talk about preemption is no preemption, but we do weigh that with other aspects of the bill, and we would actually prefer the current language in 2735 with both the grandfather clause and that window for other local governments as well. But we do understand the concerns being voiced by the park owners and others. And like I said, we think there are other very good aspects of this bill. We don't want it held up. We want the bill moved forward. And so with that concern, we support the bill and the amendment that Senator Monroe has mentioned.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for AARP? Thank you, Mr. Bennett.
And, Mr. Chair, we now have the amendment B-29.
We do.
That does exactly that.
Could you,
if you want to move this now, I would ask that we would call Chris Edwards because he wanted to be here when we move this. But I have.
Can we call Representative Holby and Representative Edwards? And have you put the amendment out so people can read it? So let's recess for, let's say,
five minutes.
Yeah, until 9:30. We'll recess until 9:30 and give people a chance to read the D-29s and get our representatives over here.
Good.
We stand in recess.
Do they not have sufficient ability now through liens, enforcement, garnishments, what have you, to collect the money?
to blur that over into the licensure process, given the way we've set up the state for all of the various things that we require licenses for, that troubles me, because I think the likelihood is we're going to trip over something.
How did this bill get out of the House 44-0 last session with a different Jessica?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors, and I would concur with my colleague, Mr. Chandler, here on his kind of perspective. From where I sit with my clients, I think that I completely agree. I think it's hard for us to sit here and know whether there's a specific problem in the construction industry with tax collection. This would be news to us. We certainly, as an industry, push to have our folks pay their taxes and do everything that they're supposed to be doing. The CCB does have enforcement powers relative to some of those things. And I know the Department of Revenue and the CCB talk to each other, and to the extent they see issues. But this would be news to us that there is an extreme problem with tax collection in the construction industry, and we'd be very concerned about legislation specifically targeting the construction industry in this regard. At this point in time, without, from our perspective, evidence that there is a specific problem with tax collection from construction companies in particular.
Great. Questions for Mr. Chandler or Jessica? Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to... Oh, Angie, are you on the A11s, please? And Margie Hoffman also, and then we'll go to the other panel.
Director, members of the committee, I actually was here on a medical client, but then I saw Bob walk in, so I figured he's got the construction side of my world covered. I would just echo the comments. I don't have anything new to add other than it seems to me, putting on my construction hat for my electrical contractors and my plumbing and mechanical contractors, that if this is a construction problem, there's a whole lot of lobbyists in this building that represent construction industries, and I mean, we just heard that it's a construction problem for the first time, so that is very concerning to us. But if this is something that someone out there wants to fix, then, you know, we're always willing to sit on a table and have a conversation. We haven't done that on this issue. So wearing that hat, what I was here to testify on is Mid-Valley IPA and Douglas County IPA. For the same reasons you've heard before, we are also opposed to the section and would support the Dash 11 amendments.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Stokes. Ms. Hoffman.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I represent the Oregon Dental Association. In the interest of saving time, I just want to echo the concerns of the public health community and say that we ask you to support the Dash 11. Thank you very much.
Great. Questions for Ms. Hoffman and Ms. Stokes? Thank you very much. Okay. Sorry for the pause there. And Harlan is going to join this panel.
Mr. Chairman, Cole Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, but I also represent the Oregon Dental Hygienists, and I would just remind you that they're the ones that have those sharp things when they clean your teeth and things.
Marty,
Mr. Chairman.
We've made the nurses furious already, so there's not much.
Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned that my gold will be gone in order for them to pay their taxes and not lose their license.
But, Mr. Chairman, I would like to discuss the sections 345, and I'd like to give you a factual scenario that is one of, I think, several that show what the concerns are of a number of us in the lending industry. Assume a commercial loan from an out-of-state bank to an Oregon company, very common. Those kinds of commercial loans are often inventory and receivable perfected with also a lien against real estate and a fixture filing. Council in Los Angeles, or the home of the out-of-state bank, does the original lending documents, and they hire somebody like me or somebody from Still Reeves or any number of law firms to act as the person who prepares the trust deed, because it's a matter of Oregon law and we want to make sure the trust deed complies with Oregon law, and the Uniform Commercial Code fixture filing. That makes me, under the terms of this bill, a part of the closing and settlement services, and it makes me an authorized agent who is responsible for the withholding responsibilities given that person under this bill. Even though none of the funds of the loan come through my hands, and even though a loan resulting in a mortgage and a UCC financing statement, I can't think of a single circumstance in which that's ever going to be a taxable transaction in the state of Oregon. You can change the scenario to talk about a lease. where the recording of the lease may also involve an organ attorney or a title company. The execution of the lease is not a transaction that is taxable, although perhaps the revenue stream thereafter might be, but this doesn't apply to the revenue stream. It applies to the closing, the creation of the thing. And I would point to you that conveyance on page 1, lines 13 and 14, doesn't just mean a sale. That's the first word. It means a lease, encumbrance, mortgage, or creation of a security interest. So in that respect, I think this bill is far too broad and encompassing. There is a second scenario that I would like to point out, too, that does involve a sale that I think also raises concerns. Some of you may be familiar with what's called like-kind exchanges, Section 1031 exchanges. And, of course, when the first sale happens, that is potentially not a taxable event, depending on what happens within the next 180-day period and whether there is a like-kind exchange through the facilitator. Under the terms of this bill, the authorized agent, whoever that be, a title company, an attorney, a facilitator, would still be required to withhold from either 4% of the consideration, that being the sales price, 4% of the net proceeds, or 10% of the gain, and turn that over to the Department of Revenue and Trust, even though within that 180-day period it's determined that it's a non-taxable event. And frankly, the person who had to have that portion of the consideration turned over would be waiting for probably several months thereafter in order to get be able to file a return to show it's a non-taxable event and get the money back. That's a second scenario. The third scenario that I would like to point out is there are a number, and by the way, there's an exemption, going back to the like-kind exchange, there's an exemption if you can get someone, a professionally competent person, it says somebody has professionally competent knowledge or advice, to say that nothing will be owed. Well, I can assure you that no attorney or CPA in that kind of a circumstance is going to be able to give an opinion that there won't be anything owed unless and until the second exchange of the like-kind exchange event is happening. The third problem I see is what is how you determine what to withhold, assuming that you do have the money in your hands. In my scenario, you might not. And that is you're supposed to withhold the lesser of 4% of the consideration, 4% of the net proceeds, or 10% of the gain, includable in taxable income. Those of you who have sold real property know that gain is a calculation that is dependent upon what the original purchase price was, what depreciation has been taken that reduces your basis in the property, what improvements that have been made that increase your basis in the property compared to your eventual sales price. The closing agent, whether it be me in the transaction I just talked about, or even a title company in normal sale, will not have access to that kind of information, and so it's unclear what we would be required to withhold because we can't determine what is the lesser of those three formulas because we cannot calculate one of those three formulas. Finally, the reason I'm particularly concerned about this and why I think it'll have a significant effect on commercial financing and commercial sales of real property transactions is that the penalty for the authorized agent, title company, attorney, or otherwise, is pretty draconian. It is in subsection 5 of section 4. If you look on page 2, it's lines 27 through 33. It says, amounts withheld, if you have the money and you make the withholding and somehow can make the calculations, or required to be withheld, which assumes that if you make a mistake, you're still responsible for what should have been withheld, must be remitted to the department, and the department may enforce collection against the authorized agent using the procedures that are used for employers who don't pay over withholding taxes. For those of you who run small businesses, you probably know how draconian that remedy is. Those people who are responsible, if you're an employer to and don't pay over withholding taxes, include the owner of the business, anybody on the board of directors, any of the officers, and anybody who has check writing authority. In my law firm, that means all of my partners have check writing authority and would be responsible if I make a mistake in the amount withheld or required to be withheld and are subject to this liability. I recognize that there may be circumstances in which out-of-state entities forget to pay organ taxes where there is a taxable gain, and I recognize that that is a problem, but I don't think that this is the solution. I think in every time we look at tax compliance issues, we need to look at what are the effects on law-abiding folks, unintended effects on law-abiding folks, and weigh those against the benefit to be derived. And I think this bill has, based on the way it's drafted now and with those and perhaps a few other additional concerns about the details, an awful lot of very serious effects on law-abiding folks that will effectively make, I don't want to say that it's a shutdown commercial financing because that's not true, but you all know how lawyers are conservative and don't like to take risks. It would be very difficult for me and my firm to act in that kind of capacity in commercial financing with this kind of potential risk, with this kind of ambiguity in this bill, and I would expect there would be other people in that same situation. Somebody will continue to do that process, but it's a very difficult bill for law-abiding folks to comply with, and I would ask you to not pass this bill. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I look at this bill, Mr. Chair, and it looks to me like it was a gut and stuff. I mean, because you have a bunch of language that was taken out of an original bill and a bunch of language here in a new bill. And all I've heard, Mr. Chair, are people that are opposed to this bill. Do we have anybody that's for this bill that's going to testify about what problem this bill solves and why we got to move this bill before we sign a die here in the next 48 to 96 hours? Because the information I'm receiving makes me wonder that this is a last-minute kind of a deal, and I don't hear anybody here saying that they're a proponent of this bill, and this bill fixes some problem that if we don't fix it today, the sky's going to fall. Mm-hmm. Is there anybody here that's proponent of the bill?
Representative Reed, I believe, carried the bill on the House floor. But I do know that it's one that was worked in the House for a period of time. I know that hearings were held in the House on this bill. And if Representative Reed, you want to come up, you want to speak, and I'd also ask Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue to join Representative Reed.
Because the testimony we just heard, Mr. Chair, is pretty compelling that this bill has some serious problems.
Mm-hmm. As always with testimony, I think there's two sides to the story, and I do know that the fiscal impact of this bill, there's a reason for it. And I would comment on Mr. Cosgrove's testimony that there are folks from outside the state, and that's where you get the fiscal impact, that are not participating in the tax system. That ought to be, that are unlawfully not participating in the tax system.
Do we have a revenue? I don't have a revenue in my file.
Revenue statement. There should be a revenue impact statement.
Yeah, it's about $4.9 million in 07 and 09. It's about $5 million a biennium.
Representative Tobias Reed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27 in Beaverton. I did have the pleasure of carrying it on the House floor yesterday. We had extensive period of question and answer, some good discussion that preceded that in both in committee and in work group. And I think the key is something the Chair has already identified. This is tax that is already due. All this bill does is give the Department of Revenue some additional tools to collect what is already owed. I would not claim to be the expert in that process, and I'm glad that Ms. Buchanan's here to answer those questions, but I can certainly talk to some of the concerns that have been expressed if you'd like to talk about that as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, Ms. Buchanan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. As was indicated, Senator Starr, there was a lot of work in the House committee on this. There was a work group put together to develop the bill. Mr. Monroe participated in the work group, as well as other representatives of industry. And if I might just speak to a few points that were raised. The bill does not require withholding when there is a non-taxable transaction. So if there is a 1031 exchange and there is no gain recognized on the exchange, withholding is not required. The
where does that say that in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, page 2, line 20. The way we envision this working is the agent has no responsibility for determining the amount or the information that is placed on the form. It's the seller of the property that's responsible for determining whether it's a taxable transaction, whether there's gain, and if so, they would indicate that on the form, and then if they're a non-resident, there would be withholding required, that is 4% of the proceeds or 10% of the gain. The seller of the property would determine how much taxable gain they expect to realize on the transaction, and the agent would be required then to withhold the 10% and remit it to the department. But if you have a non-taxable transaction, whether it's a loan where there's no gain, whether it's a refinance where there's no gain, a like-kind exchange with no gain, withholding is not required on any of those transactions.
But how does the agent know that?
The agent, Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, is not required to know that. They will hand a form to the seller. The seller will say, this is a 1031 exchange. Check the box that says 1031 or non-taxable exchange. Hand it back to the agent, and the agent will send us that form. And that's the extent of the agent's responsibility.
So what if the, but then the, ultimately under sub 5 of section 4, you hold the agent responsible?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, thank you. If I could address that, as was pointed out, you're treated as an employer would be treated. When you have employees and you withhold taxes from those employees' wages, you're required to remit those to the Department of Revenue. You hold those in trust for the state. Those are not your monies. This provision says if that agent withholds that money and doesn't remit it to the state, the same provisions that are in current law are going to apply to that agent as far as penalties for not remitting the money. That's the only penalty that applies. So it's only when that agent takes the money and doesn't remit it to the state that there's a penalty involved. If the agent accepts the seller's statements on the form and as fact and doesn't withhold any money, and it turns out that that's incorrect, the agent has no liability, no responsibility at all. It's the seller of the property who is filling out a form under penalty of perjury and asserting that either they are liable for the withholding or they are not.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I appreciate this conversation. It's helpful. And it's not, you know, we're just exchanging information here. So,
yes, sir.
How is that different than a process today if you have an individual from out of state that's buying or selling property in the state of Oregon and owes taxes? I mean, I would guess that they know that they have a tax liability if they're doing business in this state. How come we can't get those dollars today?
Mr. Chairman, Senator
Sarnoff, how does this fix that?
That's a very good question, and we look at this as being a tool that does help fix that. It's our belief that the majority of people don't intentionally avoid paying Oregon tax on property that they sell in Oregon. But sometimes people don't understand that when they sell that property at a gain, they have a liability. They may sell it in January, and by the time they get around to filing the tax returns next year, if they're living in Tucson, Arizona, they may have forgotten that they needed to file an Oregon return and pay tax, whether conveniently forgotten or intentionally forgotten or simply forgotten. So what this is in a way a reminder to that person that they need to file and report the gain to Oregon, and if they owe additional tax on the gain, they'll be remitting that. If they have a refund coming, we will send them a refund. But what we are getting and what we find to be probably most helpful is information, a form that the person has filled out to say, this is the property I sold. I am exempt from withholding under this condition. It was a non-taxable exchange. Or it was my principal residence, so there's no gain that's to be reported. Or I sold it at a loss. Any of those reasons is going to exempt them from the withholding requirement. But if they are subject to withholding, then they will write a check and the agent will send us the money. But that's the limit of the agent's responsibility. We're not saying that agent is going to have some huge job to figure out whether or not this is a taxable transaction, how much taxable gain is involved, how much depreciation the person took. The agent doesn't have to do any of that at all. What they need to do is have a form, hand it to the person, and say, are you exempt under any of these things or not? If you're not, we need to send the Department of Revenue a check equal to the lesser of these amounts.
Who was in the work group in the House?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Monroe, Jack Monroe.
Mr. Chisholm participated by telephone. I'm trying to remember all the other folks. Representative Olson was also involved.
I believe Tim Martinez may have been there, or do I have the wrong one?
I don't think he was there in person.
Mr. Monroe, do you recall?
It wasn't me.
Mr. Chisholm is
yourself.
He was
legislator.
Jack, well, just a moment, we'll have you back up, because we don't get you on the mics. Okay, so anything further, Representative Reed, that we haven't covered? We have this whole issue of the A11s in terms of professional licensure.
I would just point out generally that this is it's a tool, again, to help collect taxes that are already owed and to do it on the front end. There's a quote, the Montana Department of Revenue director, that I found pretty interesting in explaining that this is also an efficiency measure. He pointed out that there's a big discrepancy between those folks who are in-state, who are residents, who pay on time, and only 27% of non-residents pay on time. Costs the state 25 times more to collect an out-of-state debt. So there's another benefit to this. In addition to gaining the taxes that are already owed, it's less expensive to do so.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Reed.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, there's an amendment that's before us that we're considering that would delete Section 15 of this bill. Does that give you a great heartburn?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I think that's Section 15 is a valuable additional tool, and I had a number of conversations yesterday about some concerns that were addressed there, and I guess I would just underscore that it's a voluntary provision. It authorizes a licensing agency, but does not obligate them to do any of these to undertake these procedures. And if they do, it's simply to ascertain whether an applicant is in compliance. They had to ask three yes-no questions. The concerns that I heard were largely about privacy, and we went to some considerable effort to verify yesterday that the conversation would be limited to those yes-no questions, and that the conversation would be limited to the Department of Revenue and the licensing agency, so there would be no place where that information would be publicly disclosed. And one other point, I suppose, on that, compliance would include, one of the questions is whether a person has failed or an applicant has failed to pay or respond to a notice of deficiency. And the key point in that is a person would not even necessarily have had to pay to be in compliance, but merely engaged in the conversation with the Department of Revenue or an appeals process, so they're actually communicating. That would still be in compliance, is my understanding. And Ms. Buchanan can correct me if I've got that wrong. So again, I think it's a voluntary process to help verify that people are paying their taxes and following the law.
Well, and follow up,
Mr. Chair, or Senator Monroe.
Thank you. There's enough concern that has been raised from enough people, including the good Senator Bates, that I believe that there would not be sufficient votes on the floor of the Senate to pass this bill as it's currently written with Section 15 in it. Given that, how would you feel about us removing Section 15?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I have not considered the revenue impact of these two sections separately. That would be one concern. The other concern is one of fairness. Again, this is the law, and we should help people follow it. I have no basis to consider the accuracy of your assessment, but or that of Senator Bates. But if that's true, I think the closer we can get to helping people follow the law, the better.
Well, just run around. You know, the revenue impact, my understanding is, does not include Section 15. Section 15, whether it's in or out, does not change the revenue impact at $4.9 million. That's been the testimony we received.
Okay.
The revenue is in the first 14 sections of this measure. Section 15, though, seems to jeopardize electoral viability of this bill considerably. I think I can tell you that when somebody of the stature of Senator Bates is strongly opposed to it, that has the weight to kill this bill on the floor of the Senate. Do you believe that saving the rest of the bill is worth doing, or should we just jeopardize the whole bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would not want to jeopardize the entire bill.
Thank you.
Representative Reed, when did some of the testimony we got is that this hasn't this kind of happened late. When did the work group start its work? And I know you're not going to remember dates, but days ago, weeks ago, or months ago?
Mr. Chairman, I would think weeks ago, you're right, I don't have the specific dates, but we had at least two work groups that were, I think, separated by a week in between. We had a number of hearings, and that does remind me to mention that this, I don't think it would be accurate to call this a gut and stuff. Perhaps it would be more accurate to call it a gut. Most of the things that were here were already here. We took a lot of other things out of it to simplify it and focus on what we believe to be a solid first step in enhancing tax compliance.
Okay, so that is helpful. So because we weren't aware of it, so this was not a gut and stuff. This was actually removing things from a bill.
We pared it down considerably, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that's helpful to know. We were not aware of that. Other questions for Deborah? If I'm in full compliance with my taxes, do I have an issue with House Bill 2592?
Mr. Chairman, if you are in full compliance, you do not have an issue with this.
Okay. Jack Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Harlan, somewhere. There you are.
Mr. Chair, may I just add one more thing that I was going to add?
Please.
Again, Paul Cosgrove representing Oregon Financial Services. I don't believe any lenders were involved in the work group. Now, maybe that's our problem, but we were not involved in the crafting of this. I can tell you, though, that on behalf of the attorneys who represent those lenders and the lenders themselves, if, in fact, the bill said, as the Department of Revenue spokesperson said it said, we wouldn't have any problem whatsoever. If we really did clear up the ambiguity and take out the penalty, I don't have any problem for having a penalty for not turning over money I've withheld. No problem. I'm very concerned about having a penalty for not turning over money I was supposedly required to uphold. The devil is really in the details. If our responsibilities were limited to providing a form to the out-of-state entity, having the out-of-state entity determine it was taxable, and then collecting whatever they said was due and turning it over, there would be no objection on behalf of lenders or people who assist lenders in these transactions. It's just that I think it puts a great deal more burden on us than that and has a great deal more ambiguity as written than that. Thank you.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe speaking on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. And our interest, obviously, is in found in the fact that we are, through our escrow operations, authorized agents. And as Mr. Cosgrove pointed out, of course, there are other people who do closings, banks, and attorneys under certain circumstances. But our traditional role, obviously, is one of essentially following the instructions of the two parties. It's a ministerial role. This bill essentially gives us a new role, that of tax collector, and I would echo Mr. Cosgrove's comment. It imposes a duty on us or anybody who's an authorized agent, and I read the penalty section exactly as Mr. Cosgrove does. It's not limited simply to a situation where we collected $100 and failed to remit it. It also covers a situation where we had an obligation to collect and didn't do so. Now, before I get to some other comments I would like to make, let me deal with a couple of issues that have come up here in conversation and seem to be providing some momentum for this discussion. The fiscal impact issue and a number has been used, and I have the highest respect for the legislative revenue people, but I would bet that they would not mortgage the ranch, be it a taxable or non-taxable transaction, on this figure. It's an extrapolation of some information that they obtained, I think, from other states who may or may not have systems that are similar to this one, the one set forth here. Second issue, the work group. I had testified and raised a number of issues about conflicts and ambiguities in this bill when it was heard, and I cannot remember specifically when that occurred. It was after, my recollection was after the May 31st closing of all other committees, so it is weeks, not months. There were two meetings. I think I was the only party other than revenue people and the department folks, and we had a sort of an hour-long discussion, and then some changes came back, and in a subsequent hearing, we testified against the bill because it didn't resolve the issues that we had dealt with.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that reference, normally in a work group, the goal is to bring the interest groups together and work toward consensus. That did not occur in this
was
case.
Not, there was no examination of the, whether it's 15 or however many other states that are out there, either how their systems work or what they say. So you and I, Senator Starr, are on the same wavelength here. When I think of a work group, I think of a group of people that get together with an identified problem, spend a lot of time looking at options, and come up with an option. That is not what at least this work group did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess I dealt with work group number and the enforcement issue that Mr. Cosgrove had raised earlier. Our problem, of course, is we have the duty. We believe we're subject to considerable sanction. We think that, as I say, the language here is awkward. Mr. Cosgrove pointed out that the definition of conveyance includes both taxable transactions and non-taxable transactions. Mortgages and leases aren't taxable transactions. Nowhere in there, again, referring back to an issue that Paul had raised, is anything mentioned about exchanges, except suddenly exchanges raise their head later on in another section dealing with the affirmation document that's part of trying to determine who might be subject. And so, you know, it's essentially unclear as to what kind of transactions might or might not be covered. You know, I don't know about the rest of you. I know that Senator Monroe is a relatively sophisticated real property party, and who would understand that, of course, there are a whole range of transactions out there that go far beyond the sort of simple sale that you and I might think of, and there are, you know, involuntary conversions, there are 1031 exchanges, there are installment sales, there are sales that involve, as one of Paul's examples sort of pointed out, multiple parties, some of whom might be in state, some of whom might be out of state. No guidance here, for example, how we handle a situation where you've got a combination of in-state and out-of-state owners who are handling this sale. Now, you know, somebody might suggest, I guess, that you can work your way through this, but the fact of the matter is, once again, we've got people who perform ministerial functions, who are not qualified to give legal opinions, who don't give legal opinions, and you're asking them to go through that morass.
Jack, we are under a call, but I'd like to get Harlan in if we could.
You can tell we don't like it. It's a badly structured.
Jack, just, I guess the question that pops up when we are under a call is if you're complying with Oregon tax law, you don't have an issue with this bill.
Well,
so this, it seems like it's after folks that are not in compliance with the tax laws of Oregon that we have all.
I mean, just because you're an out-of-state seller, you don't know whether or not...
I'm just worried, Mr. Chair, Paul Cosgrove. It's the in-state people who are help facilitating these that I'm worried about, their liability. I'm not worried about you going after the out-of-state sellers who aren't paying taxes. It's the liability for the people in Oregon who are helping facilitate these transactions that I think I raised the concerns for. And we are, as I said, we're trying to follow the law, and I think the law here is very unclear and puts a lot of liability on us for the actions or inactions of those out-of-state people. That's my concern.
Senator Deckard, I think it probably Mr. Levy will point out, but I mean, it's not just the out-of-state party that's disadvantaged by this.
Jack, we need to get the mic up to you because no one can hear you.
It's not just the out-of-state party that might be disadvantaged by this. It's the in-state party that also might be disadvantaged. If a sale fails because you can't make this determination because there's a loan lock that expired, there's an Oregonian that's hurt. If the Californian who's selling the piece of property ends up, well, at the end of the tax year having no gain, but having had money withheld and can't buy the second vacation home or whatever it is that they wanted to buy in Oregon. It's an Oregon seller that was hurt. So it's
but isn't the solution to that to understand the law and comply with the law?
Well, but again, one of the points I think we're making, Senator, is that this measure as it's structured here almost defies understanding in some circumstances. And if you know, there have been a lot of comment about other states. California's sort of simple citizens' understanding of their statute is 16 pages long. And their statute apparently has definitely more specificity with regard to how certain kinds of transactions are to be treated. And it also creates a different duty. The duty's on the buyer, not somebody who's performing a ministerial function, the closing agent.
I mean, I just keep falling back to, and it's Representative Butler, who's a CPA, who drafted this bill. And I do remember from 2 years ago, because I was sitting in the same chair, when he drafted very similar, and we've been working on. And I harken back to Representative Butler, and it really is his CPA experience, is that these tend to be sophisticated transactions with CPAs involved, whose job is to understand the law and comply with the law. And it goes back 2.5 years that we had those conversations, but they were pretty emphatic to me, coming from a licensed CPA, that you might hear these arguments. I remember when he was proposing similar type legislation.
Senator Deckard, I don't recall what happened two sessions ago. I heard Representative Butler's name associated with the other provision dealing with license compliance. I haven't sat down to compare what's here with with some sort of real property provision that might have been
in
the 2003 bill. I can tell you that Representative Butler conducted what probably many yesterday considered to be a filibuster in raising questions about this bill, and specifically about the real property provisions in Section 4. And so he obviously had a number of problems with the bill as it is before you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Starr.
I would suggest that that there is likely a problem here. But I would also suggest that this isn't the likely solution to that problem based on the information that I've heard this afternoon, that ultimately we need to get to the persons that are responsible to pay the taxes. And based on this information on this bill and the testimony that we've heard, it seems to be that this the target of this potentially is the kind of the middle person who ultimately isn't the guy or the person or the individual that's responsible for paying the tax. And it seems to me that the work group that was convened in the House didn't have a broad enough membership to get those issues on the table and get it addressed in a way that you can have a workable statute.
We're not going to have time to open up. We are under call, but we won't have time, obviously, this session to reopen.
Well, and I would suggest that this is maybe something that we can work on in the interim to come back in a short session in February to address. I think, legitimately, there's an issue here that we need to address. I just suggest that this isn't the bill as a vehicle. As well-meaning in the work that has been done in the House, it appears to me that we don't have a solution to the problem as the words in this paper seem to create a mechanism that's problematic for the folks. I think that it's the wrong folks are targeted here.
Mr. Levy, we can come back to you. It's up to you, or you could.
I can be real quick, Chair Deckard. For the record, members of the committee, my name is Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We also oppose House Bill 2592. I'm not going to repeat all of the testimony that you've heard, but suffice it to say we agree with much of what you've heard. Just wanted to point out one additional issue that we would hope that you would consider, and that's the effect that this bill might have on real estate investment in Oregon. Out-of-state investors might see this as a deterrent. They could put their money in other states and not have to worry about some of these problems that we'd be creating in this bill. It wouldn't be as difficult for them to go through a transaction, to do a 1031 exchange, as it would be in Oregon under this bill, should this bill become law. So we're concerned that this bill could have some unintended consequences on the real estate market as a whole. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Harlan. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to recess for... Yeah, just leave it all here. Madison, is House Revenue, what are they doing? Other than working on bills like this. They're delayed. Till we're done? Oh, well, okay. We recess then. Okay, so we'll stand in recess until... I want to say, how many bills do we have on the floor?
We're just using the schedule from this morning.
Do you want to do this one, the conflict amendment?
Yeah, but we can't do it right now. So we'll recess until 3:30. We'll stand in recess until 3:30. Representative Tom Butler.
Thank you, Chair Decker, members of the committee. Tom Butler from House District 60. Thank you very much for your consideration. With regard to the Section 15, I did in fact in a previous session have a bill that had asked the Department of Revenue to work much closer with the agencies to share information back and forth so that we could make certain that that agencies that had privileged licensure going on in the state of Oregon were actually doing a better job of making sure that those licensees were applying for and receiving their licenses when they were in fact paying their taxes. We did a sample with the Department of Revenue and found out that one-third of the people who had one kind of license were not filing an income tax return in the state of Oregon. That gave us plenty of reason to come back and say, wait a minute, are all of our agencies in the state of Oregon complying? Now, I do have some information from that previous activity that we were involved in that indicated that there are a lot of folks, even state and public employees, who are not paying their taxes on time and are in fact delinquent on taxes. So it was just an attempt to try and get the agencies to work more closely together with the department. I understand you're going to work that as a separate section of the bill.
I think we're going to take that out, but I mean, given that statistic, I think there are folks that would like to work with you to at least find an amicable way of solving that issue of how do you share information in a way that doesn't light up everyone that's affiliated with it. So I don't think it's going to make it into this bill, but...
Mr. Chair, I fully appreciate and agree with exactly what you're saying, that really the information needs to be as opposed to a compulsory and a double stick with no carrot arrangement. It needs to be something that we can work together with jointly back and forth between the agencies with the Department of Revenue, and there's a method of doing that and doing it systematically. With regard to the remaining portion of the bill, my greatest concern was that we are shifting a portion of the burden over to the escrow agents, the real estate agents, and lawyers who close real estate transactions, and my concern was that to the extent that you can leave the liability or the responsibility on those folks who are closing real estate transactions to merely collecting the amount that the people attest that they owe by filling out the form that the department will provide and then remitting that form over, remitting that amount over, as opposed to having them with any touch of liability in this bill. You'll still collect every bit as much. And there should not be the problem of putting at risk law offices who close real estate transactions, agents who close real estate transactions in their offices. Also, the 351 accommodators could be held liable, and they could be out of state. My concern is that creates a whole layer of additional people outside the state of Oregon who could be liable and never know anything about our law nor be involved with the state of Oregon laws. So it could be cleaned up, and I appreciate that there's a time issue here, but I think with just a little bit of work, particularly with Jack Monroe and the Land Title Associations in Oregon, they could tighten up that language. You would still have every bit of money that's collected in this regard, but then I would also then ask for the Department of Revenue to come forward and tell you that they will not just collect the money and say thank you very much, that they will actually then begin to work those accounts and say, wait a minute, we collected $100,000 from you on a large real estate deal. You didn't file a tax return. Why don't you file a tax return so that we can credit the $100,000 and collect any additional or return to you what access there is. In other words, not just passively taking the money and saying thank you, but taking the money and then actively working the accounts. I think that there's a an opportunity that might be lost in this process if we don't work it.
Well, we have a huge time issue to work this House bill. Let's get Senator George and Senator Starr.
Representative Butler, if you owe me money, I don't go tell your cousin to give me money. And the point of it is, I agree with you, that if we said to the department, we want you to act on this like we're acting on a avoidance of cigarette tax, and we aggressively pursue those individuals doing this, but to go out here and put someone else in harm's way, to me, is just, I find it offensive, and I don't think it's the most efficient way to collect the tax. Any comment on that?
Thank you, Vice Chair George. And yes, to your question, I think that there is a way where you could actually make this a proactive method of really drilling the information and getting more money out of it than just the four-plus, nearly $5 million that's estimated to be collected and then abandoned in this process. That if the department will take the money and then agree to go ahead and work those accounts, it's my understanding and belief at this particular point that we could let these folks off the hook who are unfortunately left as partly liable in this process, who are doing nothing more than they've done in the past, and that is close real estate transactions the way that they should be doing. It leaves them without any liability other than to pay over the collected taxes which they have received in a fiduciary capacity, but then the department could go ahead and take those taxes, match up the Social Security numbers, and Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee, we had testimony that the department at present is not even asking for the 1099s on real estate transactions. Currently, the 1099 S&B, the brokerage and sales statements, are not even being audited at this particular time. You've got a brand new form here that provides a whole plethora of information that is new to the department, and we already receive and have the ability to receive the 1099 B for brokerage statement and S for sales of real estate transactions that we do not presently and I could be wrong on this, that we do not presently demand to receive from the closing agents, or that we do not presently go out and drill that information back. If all we're going to do is just add a new tax for collection, then it's my position that possibly this bill really requires 36 votes, or 18 in the Senate. But I believe that we can do a better job, and that was a portion of my bill back from a couple of sessions ago.
Senator Starr.
Well, my point, and I wish the chair were here to hear it, my point is that the amendment to the concept that Representative Butler just clearly enunciated and articulated is basically the amendment we're having drafted right now in council to put the onus on the appropriate party to pay the tax, and we can collect it, and we can get the $4.5-5 million that we need, and then we can pass this bill with unanimous support, and we don't have a fight on our hands.
And Vice Chair George and Senator Starr, yes, that's entirely possible. You need the Department of Revenue as an active participant in this process, rather than just having a new form. Mm-hmm. And there was never any indication as to any fiscal in putting this information together to have the information from every real estate transaction for an out-of-state corporation for an out-of-state address. There was never any indication of the cost that it would take to begin to manage that information, when right now, today, we could be receiving the 1099 brokerage statements, and we're not actively pursuing those.
So you're saying managing the new process may be more difficult than activating the auditors to go in and pursue this thing drilling down in, as you were describing.
Mr. Chair, if I was an economist, and I'm not an economist, I'm just an accountant, but if I was an economist, I would tell you that from my experience, there is more money waiting on 1099 audits in the state of Oregon than there are on those brokerage and real estate transactions than there will be in this particular method of pursuing folks. But the other side of it, and this did come out in the testimony on the House floor yesterday, was, hey, wait a minute. Here you don't have to pursue them. You've already collected the money. What you've got to do then is you've got to go out and say, do you owe more? And if you don't hear from them, then do we have the resources to go ahead and start to tap them out of state? And really, we don't. There's no additional resources provided in this process.
Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We need a little break here.
I noticed that the good representative said he was not an economist, he was an accountant, and I wondered if the good representative knows the difference.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Monroe, I do have a degree in economics, but after being around a group of economists, you know, I thought accountants were really boring at first.
Well, that goes to the difference, you see, because an economist is somebody that's very good with numbers, but doesn't have the personality to be an accountant.
Sorry,
okay, let's see if there's anybody we haven't insulted here today.
Sorry, Nathan. Mr. Vice Chair, Senator George, Vice Chair George, Senator Monroe, Senator Farioli said that a really outgoing accountant is one, when he presents his report, will look at your shoes instead.
Well, I suppose that we're going
Deborah,
to...
Deborah wants
oh, Deborah,
to
okay, come on down. Deborah, I have to tell you, I was sitting there as the good representative was speaking, and I was thinking that's exactly what we should do, is to dedicate the more money to drill down in and allow you guys to capture some of this, but not by bringing a third party in. So go ahead and respond however you would like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. The process that Representative Butler described is exactly how I see the process working in the current bill. In my opinion, there isn't an onus placed on the agent in this process. What I'm giving you is a form that's used in Colorado. Colorado has a similar law that requires withholding on the sale of real property. It's my view that we would develop a form similar to this. The agent hands this to the seller of the property. They look at it, and if they're exempt from withholding, you'll notice under item 12, these are the reasons withholding is not required under Colorado law. If the person asserts that they are not required to have withholding because they're a Colorado resident or because they have a permanent place of business in Colorado, they check the box, they sign it on the back, the agent sends it to us. If they can't check one of the boxes, withholding is required. The withholding is calculated. They send us the form with the withholding. That's the burden on the agent in this process, is to get the form filled out by the seller. They don't have to verify any of this. They don't have to verify the person is really a Colorado resident. No one is going to have to verify Oregon residency. You're relying on the seller to assert that this is a fact and to sign the form and to send it to us. As far as drilling down, Senator, we now have auditors that go to county records and research property sales in order to determine whether people should be filing returns and reporting sales to Oregon. They're doing that now. It is a lot of work, especially to try to find sales by out-of-state residents. So this information that we're getting, not only are we getting the withholding for people that aren't exempt, but we're getting information. If we get this form along with withholding, I would certainly hope that we're going to follow up with that person and ask, where's your return down the road when they don't file with us? Or if they send in the form and they say they're exempt and we don't see a return from them, why don't we have a return? So, yes, we're going to drill down, but we don't look at it as using more resources to implement this. It ought to actually save in costs for the department and increase our efficiency. And finally, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, just with the 1099s, we do get the 1099s, but we get them from the IRS electronically, and that's one of the reasons we don't ask to have them sent in by the agent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Starr.
Thank you. I appreciate the form from Colorado. Does the language in this bill mirror the language in the Colorado statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I didn't draft the language, so I don't know whether
you have
they
a copy of the Colorado statute.
And Ms. Buchanan is not the sponsor of this bill, so I don't want to put her in a position of.
Well, she seems to be the advocate for the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I'm simply trying to provide information.
It's just the department that's trying to answer our questions.
As to how we would implement it.
My understanding is it does amount to that. I was just told, again, it amounts to just handing this form off to a seller or to And then at that point, my liability, if I was a real estate agent, that is the extent of my obligation.
Mr. Chairman, the only provision in the bill that places a burden or a penalty on the agent is if they receive the withholding and don't send it to us, or if the person fills out the form and says, yes, I'm required to have withholding, and the agent doesn't withhold. And in the current law provisions that apply to employers that withhold money and are required to remit it would apply as far as a penalty. And that's it. That's the only burden on. If the agent takes the form and sends it to us, that's their only obligation with the withholding, if the withholding was required.
Okay. Senator George, and then we need to...
Really quickly. Is that current penalty on the withholding, which would be similar or identical to what we're going to do here, is that a percentage of the total? Because these could be enormous transactions. I'm just wondering what kind of harm's way those people still may be in relative to a penalty if, in fact, they don't get the numbers right.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I'm going to have to look at the statute for the penalty provisions that relate to unremitted tax. I don't know that one off the top of my head.
And, Mazin, if we could get it would be helpful to get the Colorado statute, if that's quick and easy to do, just to see how this mirrors the language that is used in, from what I understand, 18 other states, which is mentioned.
Mr. Chairman, there are at least 12. We heard testimony in the House committee that there were 15 other states. I would also just note that California just changed their law in the last few years to expand this to require withholding on residents. They had started out only on non-residents and have expanded it now to include residents. So apparently it's working well enough that they've broadened
their law.
They've
expanded it from non to
right.
residents.
Right.
Okay. I think we got everyone on the public testimony part of House Bill 2592. Are there others that would like to?
Thank you.
That's fine. Sure. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2592. Are we prepared to do the conflict amendments on? Where's the agenda? What, 3744 or 2752?
The A-10 amendments?
Yes, the A-10 amendments. So I don't know if the right staff is here, so I will play LRO staff. These are conflict amendments, the A-10s that we got to 2752 when we passed it out of committee, so we would again have to get the script out and undo.
Do you want to do that, Mr. Chair?
I do.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for the purposes of reconsidering the vote by which we passed House Bill 2752 to the Senate floor.
Senator,
did you close that hearing?
I did close.
Oh,
did you open
a
work session?
Open a work session on House Bill 2752.
Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules by which the committee passed House Bill 2752 to the Senate floor.
Senator Starr has moved that we suspend the rules by which we passed House Bill 2752 to the Senate floor. Any dissension?
For the purpose of reconsideration.
Correct. Exactly.
Any dissension? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2752 to the Senate floor.
Senator Starr has moved that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2752 to the Senate floor. Discussion. Objections to that motion. So ordered.
Now we have the bill in front of us.
Now we have the bill in front of us.
Mr. Chair, I move the -810 amendments to House Bill 2752.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
I believe we have to rescind the A-9 amendments first.
I'm not certain that we have to do that.
I am not either.
According to this script, we do.
Is that on
that?
That
was the official script.
Okay. Senator Starr, there was A-9s.
Let's resend. I move that we resend the A-9 amendments to House Bill 2752.
Senator Starr has moved that we resend the A-9 amendments to House Bill 2752. Discussion. Objections. So ordered, Senator Starr.
Okay. I move the -810 amendments to House Bill 2752.
Senator Starr has moved the adoption of the A-10 amendments to House Bill 2752. Discussion. Objections. So floor. Senator Starr.
Move the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2752 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Whoever was carrying that one will continue to carry that one.
Mr. Chairman.
yes, Senator George.
If we could not call an objection.
You want to do the roll?
No. That's okay. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Okay, let's open a work session. I do this gingerly on House Bill 2171. There are eight amendments that I think are the most likely to pass on 2171.
B8.
The B8s.
Chair, I'll move the B8 amendments to 2171.
We have a description of what they're doing.
Yeah. Although, Nathan, are you working 2171?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, we're back with the proper person. So let's talk about the B8s and what those do and don't do.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, B8 basically a simple amendment. What it does, it takes back 2171 House Bill to what it used to be with the A version. So it removes the addition that you have on page 7, page 7, section 12, when you have the line 37 to 45, this is the allowable or permissible language that allows for the local governments to add its own taxation system. That basically is taken out of the bill, and this was put into the bill, which made it be engrossed. So this basically takes it to being the old A engrossed, although it would be a C engrossed.
Wasn't, I'm sorry, we were talking a little bit when you were doing that. Would that affect the B7 amendment?
I think it probably will affect the B7 amendment. The B7 amendment was
the limited amendment on the population of 90,000 or more to impose right. The privilege tax.
The B7 amendment will change the bill based on that section. So if you take that section out, it probably will not work with that.
There's no authority to do B7.
Right.
Did you move the B8 in a row?
I did.
Okay. Well, let's vote on those. Are there... well, I know there are. Just further discussions of the B8s.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Rowe.
The base bill, 2171, is critical to OLCC, otherwise we're going to be tied up in courts. Some of us, and I've been one of them, been playing a few little games with this bill. There's reasons for that, but we're nearing the end of the session, and this is critical legislation that must be approved. So that's why I have moved the B8 amendments.
Mr. Johnson.
Senator George.
I can assure you I haven't been playing any games relative to the bill, and I would hope that nor was Senator Monroe. And we had understanding earlier, the B8 significantly changed the ability of our local jurisdictions to do anything about the cost being incurred to that county, I understand, relative to a certain industry. And I just object. I really think this is, I mean, first of all, we went from a good bill. Now it's a very bad bill.
You know, I want to say, Senator George, and I don't know if this is helpful at all. The more I've learned about the way we tax vineyards, is I think it's an issue worthy of further exploration. I don't know if that's helpful at all, but it does seem to me that that is something that at least we ought to learn more about. And Yamhill County has brought up, I think, some legitimate issues that came very, very late. But it's something that I think interim committees could certainly We are now a more annualized legislature, and I think you've brought very surprisingly, and I think what Senator Larry George brought in terms of the charts and the differential treatment was something that I just simply did not know, and I would be pledged as one. I don't think this is in any way going to solve your issue, but certainly would pledge myself to learn more about that situation, because I think it's been educational for us to see the situation in Yamhill County, and I would hope that the Vineyards work with, because Salem is not the place that this ought to be adjudicated, and so I would just hope that the Vineyards in Yamhill County would work with the county, and what probably is a more collaborative relationship than the one that they have now.
Can I have a question to Mawson?
Sure.
Again, on the Dash 8? This is a preemption against them doing anything to Dash 8. Is that correct, the way it's going to end up being?
The Dash 8, Senator George, would just basically take out the permissible language that otherwise would have been in the bill. So this basically remains as a state taxation issue rather than local. And I think, as Senator Deckard has said, we probably need to discuss this over a glass of wine.
Right now I have coffee and I'm wired.
I mean, the B8's just returning to the original form of the bill, the 2171. Further discussion on the B8's.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I didn't intend to preempt Senator George's ability to make other motions. I don't know if those will still be in order or not. And I certainly do not think the issue of the fact that we have the lowest beer tax in the nation and one of the lowest wine taxes in the nation is an issue that's going to go away. And I certainly will be advocating, already have, with presiding officer, that these be issues for discussion during the interim. So out there, all you folks are pre-warned.
Okay, further discussion. Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Nope.
Aye.
Aye. What's up?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
If a motion was made on the B7s, is that motion, because the way the B7s are drafted, would that even be, at this point, did the B7, could we even
move
the B7s into this bill? Because the B7s basically say delete lines 42 of 45 of the being gross bill, and the B8s already take that out.
Sure, I don't think we've made any motions in the B7.
No, but I think his question is, if there was a motion made to adopt the B7s, how did those interact with the B8s, the adoption of the B8s?
Well, I believe, Senator Starr, the B8 is the start of the B7. In other words, you need the allowable or the permissible language in the bill itself in order to practice the B7. So once you do the B8, you have removed this permissible language. So it might end up as language to do something without the ability that is given in the statute to do it. So, but if you want, we could call council and have more discussion about it.
Senator Starr, are you interested in further?
As I read it, I believe that you do not have the ability, based on the adoption of the B8s, to amend the bill further with the B7s, based on the fact that you eliminated, we just deleted lines 37 through 42 or 41, which I think are necessary, which are necessary in order to qualify the new section 2, which the B7s create. So I think I have answered my own question upon reading the bill. Mr. Chair.
Sir, sure.
We do not have a motion on the table, right?
We do not.
But under discussion of the overall issue, I think that I agree with the statements that have been basically made by both Senator Monroe and Senator George. I think that there is an issue that needs to be dealt with. And parts of our state that folks visit. Over the on Father's Day, my family and I took a trip participated in some of those activities in rural Yamhill County. And I'll tell you that there's a lot of people out there on a Sunday afternoon. And you know, this is an issue that ought to be looked at and ought to be dealt with. But I think that there's larger issues as well in the whole interface between urban and rural. Historically in my family, we operated a truck garden where we invited folks from the more urban and suburban community out to the rural parts to pick vegetables. And you know, and some weekends we'd have hundreds of vehicles out on our farm and doing what they do and picking the vegetables and the berries and whatnot. So there is an interface at some level and some times of the year. You look at Sobeys Island in October, how many hundreds of or thousands of Portlanders or folks from the city that go out to the country to get pumpkins. There's other pumpkin places besides Sobeys Island, but that's the one that came to mind. So those are issues, and we need to figure out how to best deal with those. And I think we need to maybe tread carefully, and I don't know that we'd want to have a special transportation tax on the way to pumpkins, or other fruits and vegetables and agricultural products that folks come out to the country to buy. So, but I do believe that there is an issue here, and one that we need to address in future legislative sessions.
Thank you. Further discussion. Well, we actually don't even have a motion.
I move the bill 2171 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved House Bill 2171 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. More discussion. Hannah, can you please call the roll?
Aye.
George?
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Folks, aye. That bill passes. Gosh, who wants to carry that one?
I'll carry it.
Who's the biggest wine drinker at the diet?
Okay.
I would know.
Senator Burnick will
somebody to my immediate right.
Okay, so we're going to recess until we're back on the floor at 4 right now. We'll recess until 4:30.
Transferor, which is how I understood the California law actually works.
Wouldn't that transfer go to an escrow company that would then remit tax? How would that actually handle? Would you guys as an agent actually transmit the money?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, the ways these transactions are closed vary greatly depending on the transaction. I've been involved in transactions, yes, where all the money flows through a title company, in which case they'd be the responsible party to do the holding. The bill is broadly enough drafted with the definitions, which I don't think Mr. Muir will be changing, that if it doesn't have a title company and the attorney doesn't get the money, which would be relatively rare that the attorney would get the money, mm-hmm. then it is the lender itself who's making the disbursement who would have to transmit the withholdings. But it's whoever has the money would have to transmit the withholdings if they're required.
Yes, Senator George, please. We're
do you think we're going to be clear with that procedure, or would that be natural to clear? What you just described, is that procedure going to be clear to everyone that, okay, you're going to end up with the money, you've got to remit it?
I certainly hope so. That was certainly what we hoped the amendment will say, and I certainly hope so, and we should have to wait and see. But I hope so.
Okay, anything further for Mr. Cosgrove? Okay, thank you, Mr. Paul. Appreciate that. Okay, we'll just stand at ease and wait. We're waiting for those amendments that we just discussed.
2 p.m.
Okay, so we're going to return from recess on House Bill 2592 and close the work session on House Bill 2592 and adjourn till tomorrow. I didn't want to name the time.